It's Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Milwaukee author Nick Petrie has given up his day job. The former contractor and building inspector now puts author in the occupation line on his tax returns. It is a welcome change, but one that was a long time coming.
Petrie has his MFA in fiction writing from the University of Washington, and more than a decade ago had won some awards for his short stories. But nothing much else was happening with his writing, and his family wasn't going to feed itself. So like many other writers, Petrie did other things to pay the bills.
Then, in 2016, The Drifter hit the bookshelves. The story of a Wisconsin veteran of the war in Afghanistan trying to find his way back to some kind of normal has all of the intrigue and explosiveness of a thriller, but also has the added plus of a complex character readers care about. Light It Up is the third and newest addition to what is now a bona fide series.
Petrie returned home to Milwaukee from a multi-week cross-country book tour last week, and he stopped by our studio then to chat about this latest book and how life has changed for him, and it turns out that surprise is still a key emotion.
The first in the series was the book that I wrote because I was pretty sure no one would ever publish anything I'd ever written, and so I just wrote something I wanted to read. And three books later, here we are, and the fourth book I'm editing right now and thinking about the fifth, and it's a kind of a crazy ride.
Yeah, I bet it is, particularly if you were convinced that nothing was ever going to happen with it.
Well, in a way, I think that's how you get free enough to sort of lay it all out there and to not leave anything in the tank. You know, it's a it's still sort of – I can't really quite believe that I walk through the airport and I see – you know, a book with my name on it. It must be somebody else. I still very much feel like that.
Well, I mean, the books are wonderful fun. Light It Up is no exception to the rule. I've enjoyed all three. And this one finds our erstwhile hero not in Milwaukee, not in Wisconsin, but in Denver or around Denver in Colorado. He's come from the West Coast, which was book number two. And what is he doing? Why is he in Colorado in this book?
Well, he's working for a security company. He's really helping a friend. And they've in the cannabis industry, if you are doing recreational cannabis, you're not allowed to have a relationship with a bank. So all of the –
even though it's legal.
It's perfectly legal on the state level. But on a federal level, a bank can lose its charter if it's doing business with essentially drug manufacturers or drug dealers, which is how the federal government still considers these legal businesses to be on the federal level. So they can't accept credit cards. They can't write checks. So the whole industry is essentially a cash-only business, and it's been billions of dollars. So they pay their employees with cash. They pay their federal taxes with cash. So
they're paying federal taxes on an illegal, technically illegal operation.
Yes, yes. Which is one of the fun ironies of this.
Yes, really.
But there's also grown up this protection industry around it. So I got started thinking about this because I read a piece in the New York Times about protection companies started by veterans in Denver hiring veterans to help these cannabis growers and retailers sort of safeguard their money and their product. And that was sort of my path in. So Peter Ash is – that's my hero is Peter Ash. He's helping a friend on a cash run, and hijackers show up, and things get very wild very quickly.
Yes, I was going to say things go wrong pretty fast, and the rest of the book is trying to get things sort of righted again for both Peter and some other close people in his life as well. You told me a really interesting story about how you even thought about the legal cannabis trade as a setting for the book. Wasn't it like an airport meeting?
That's right. It was a chance meeting in the Phoenix airport. I was on tour for my first book, The Drifter, just over 2 years ago. And I was early and sitting in a coffee shop and writing in my little journal and trying to figure out this next book. And I met a guy who, as it turns out, was on his way to Portland, Oregon to start a cannabis grow operation. And I said, so gosh, what qualifies you to do this? I was imagining he was a botanist or something with a PhD who'd been a consultant for the hothouse tomato industry or something like this, right? And he gave me sort of this look and this sly little smile. And he said, well, this is my first legal cannabis grow. And so we had a lot of conversation after that. I had a lot of questions. And he very generously sort of told me the story of how he got started in California growing pot in a two-car garage, and he went all the way up to a big 10,000-square-foot commercial facility and sort of his adventures along the way. So he was one of the inspirations and a really neat guy.
Do you stay in touch with him? Has he read this book?
I don't know if he's read it or not, but I got an email from him not long ago with a couple pictures of his previous grow. So I have it's fun. One of the greatest things about being a writer is these relationships you develop along the way. And I'm kind of a nosy guy to begin with, but it gives you license to really, you know, stick your nose into all sorts of corners. And if you just say, well, I'm a writer and I'm trying to write a book, and people tell you all kinds of crazy stuff.
Well, I mean, I'm just imagining, you know, meeting this guy and then finding out about all of these illegal – because in California, as far as I know, it still is illegal.
Well, no. January 1st, it went legal. And so
okay.
That's why it's set in Denver. Denver was the first state – or Colorado was the first state to really go big on legalizing cannabis. But it was – I think the number I last read for 2017 was $7.7 billion, and that was in four states. In its second year of legality in those four states. And then California came online this year. Massachusetts is coming online. Nevada is coming online. Alaska as well. So this market's only getting bigger. It's just a fascinating sort of social issue to tap into. And I think that's one of the reasons that this book has gained a lot of traction is it's a window into this little universe.
That's not so little.
Well, no, it's getting bigger by the minute.
Yeah.
But you know, I talk to growers, I talk to retailers, I talk to security folks. You know, so this is sort of a, you know, this is a little glimpse into this funky little world. And here in Wisconsin, you know, we don't even have medical marijuana here, so a lot of people don't know much about this. And I don't really take a position on it one way or the other. I think the jury's still out on, you know, what the effects are. I have a 17-year-old son. So, you know, I have a teenager and, I have mixed feelings about it, but it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Right. Well, as a plot part of your book, or a great place to put Peter into, I mean, it's a wonderfully, in some ways, as you say, it's unknown by a lot of people. So, you know, we can really kind of find our way into that world through him in this book. And that was fascinating to me because I had no idea that it was cash only and that, you know, you had all of these veterans who were basically being entrepreneurs and setting up these protection details and that sort of thing. And for Peter, who suffers from PTSD, and we learn about it in the first book and he's starting to work on it and he's working on it through the second book. Would you say he's getting better?
I guess the goal is for me to show kind of one person's path through this challenge. And it's not the same path for everybody. There are as many different kinds of post-traumatic stress as there are people who suffer from it. This has become an issue that's really near and dear to my heart. It's important to me to show that there is a path through and sort of what the – sort of one of some of the common steps are. So I would like him to continue to improve, but – I learned very quickly that people really don't get over war. I know people who fought in Vietnam who still think about it every single day. It's really, you know, a life-changing experience if you are on the ground. You know, it's not that he's going to get over it or he's going to get better, but it's an evolution. And it's more about learning to live with sort of the aftermath of your war. One of the things Peter says when the white static shows up is he's trying to think of it as a companion. So he says, hello, old friend, kind of to himself. But this, you know, the static is in a way kind of another character. It's his sort of combat awareness showing up.
Right. And he does in Light It Up, he does befriend it in some ways. I mean, sometimes he's still antagonistic with it because it still can control him in ways that he doesn't want it to. But he's seeing it more as an ally than a foe, it seems to me, in this book.
Well, that's the goal, and I think it's a gradual process. I mean, I know vets who haven't been at war for 10 or 12 years who are still very much dealing with it directly. I met a guy at a convention who had been Army Airborne and had been out for 10 years, and he couldn't go into the awards hall. It was too many people. It was too close. It was just too much. You know, this is a long haul, and some people are. I don't want to paint a picture of all veterans as horribly damaged. That's not how this works at all. But about 20% of people who've served in combat have some of this residual effect. And for some people, it's a few months. For some people, it's a few years. For some people, it really is a lifetime. And it really is just about sort of developing a relationship with yourself. For me, one of the most fascinating things about it was that the kind of the first thing that they say you should be doing is join a veterans group, because you can talk to people who are suffering from some of the same things that you are. It doesn't have to be your same war. It doesn't even have to be the same, you know, you're certainly not the same branch of the service, but people who've seen who are having a similar experience, which helps kind of normalize it in your head. And that's how you retrain the brain to sort of turn down this fight or flight impulse, which is really what post-traumatic stress is. It's just this overactive fight or flight impulse.
Right. It never shuts off.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're just constantly ready for something that's not there.
Right. Right.
Right.
That's the other thing that I try to tell people is that there's nothing wrong with you if you have post-traumatic stress. It's a normal human reaction to a difficult period of time. So, you can, for many people, learn to deal with this. But don't think of yourself as broken. There's nothing wrong with you. This is normal stuff.
One of the other things you deal with so well in all of the books is this idea, again, going back to combat and veterans who have served in that kind of in extremis. Shakespeare calls it the band of brothers. You know, that sense of camaraderie, knowing that guy or that woman sitting next to you, you can trust your life with. And that kind of comes around in lots of interesting different ways in all of your books, but also in this one particularly.
You know, I think one of the reasons, again, these books have gained so much traction is that I'm interested in writing about character and I'm interested in writing about relationships. And yes, these are fun books and fast reads and there's, you know, car chases and, you know, fist fights and all that.
Lots of good weaponry.
Yeah, all that fun stuff. But at its heart, it really needs to be about human relationships and characters that feel real on the page. And I'm really interested in kind of male friendship and this idea of that kind of unconditional friendship and commitment that if you've served in combat with somebody. I know guys who will happily climb in their car and drive for 10 hours to help a buddy that they served with. And to me, it's a very profound thing, and it's part of what I'm trying to explore, especially with the relationship between Peter and his friend Lewis, who didn't serve in the war together, but they do have that same kind of relationship, that same kind of friendship.
I love their relationship because there is this really wonderful – I mean, it's both very lighthearted, considering both of them have some very serious things that they're dealing with, but it's also incredibly – as profound is exactly the word – they – truly are brothers from another mother.
Well, and I'm really interested in this idea, you know, we all bleed green. The armed forces were really pioneers in race relations in this country and showing that as well in these stories. To me, it's an interesting wrinkle. My goal is to sort of show these things in as realistic a way as I can. I mean, yeah, there's some goofy, outrageous stuff in these stories, but I hope the relationships really feel real. And race is really interesting. I worked as a carpenter and a contractor for years and years, and you know the job site is full of people of all shades and backgrounds, and it's a very interesting dynamic in the trades, and I see it in the armed forces as well. You know, you may not think well of a certain group of people, except for this guy, who is always helping me or always takes the heavy end of the board or whatever, and it really is proximity that lets you see people as people.
Lewis is a character that I love. He is from the North Side and he still lives on the North Side. Where did he come from for you?
As a character?
Yeah.
Well, in a way, Lewis is sort of the part of me that doesn't want to play by the rules. You know, Lewis is a guy who came up very poor, living a very hard life, and found solace in the library, which, you know, I didn't grow up very poor in a very hard way, but I found solace in the library myself. One of Lewis's favorite lines is the quote from Malcolm X, the most dangerous man in America, is a black man with a library card. And so actually similarly to Peter, Lewis really sort of lives by his own personal code of conduct. And it doesn't necessarily coincide with what the law says. But when you're a career criminal the way Lewis was, he's sort of given that up, sort of. You know, you need to develop a set of rules for yourself. And I was self-employed for, you know, years and years and years. And I never had a boss looking over my shoulder. I sort of had to do the same thing. You know, this is how I want to live in the world. And I think those are interesting questions. And so Lewis says he developed a code and then he had to change it because of some stuff that happened in the first book. His life is evolving. But he's also this smart guy who's interested in everything and is really self-taught, first the library and then the internet. I know lots of folks who, you know, have essentially invented themselves and are reinventing themselves all the time. And I think that's a fascinating dynamic to pay attention to.
Well, and it's such an interesting journey that he's having with Peter. The two of them are having – I mean, I know it's mostly Peter's books, but I find Lewis to be a wonderful – he's not really an antagonist. I'm trying to think of the right word for him. He's sort of a co-traveler.
Yeah, I didn't want him to be a sidekick. I want him to really be a kind of a partner in the process. And Lewis has his own little fan club. I mean, people really feel very strongly about Lewis as well. People always ask, "Is Lewis coming back in the next book?
Is he going to have his own book?"
Yeah. Well, I it would be fun to have. You know, usually Lewis shows up to help Peter at some point, and I would like to have a book where Peter shows up to help Lewis. So I'm sort of that's one of the things that's percolating in the back of my brain, because he is such an interesting and complex character.
So I'm hoping that however that percolates to the top and however you end up writing it, that you will come back and tell us about it. But Nick Petrie, it is always great to see you. Congratulations on the success of all of this. I understand that this is your full-time job now.
This is my full-time job, and thank you very much. It's a little strange to not be tethered to the daily work world. I feel sort of like Wile E. Coyote after he's run off the cliff. I'm just trying – my legs are going. I'm trying really hard not to look down. I mean, I miss what I used to do. I miss driving around the city and meeting new people every day. I even miss climbing up on the roof and, you know, bonking my head in the basement. But it's really freeing to sort of say, you know, this is it. This is what I'm doing, and the week opens up, the month opens up in a very different way, and I can already sort of feel things changing in my fevered little brain about, you know, more ideas percolating up, and so it's been a great change, and I'm very grateful to the readers for helping me do that.
Well, and I was going to say, if you miss it too much, you can always go down in your basement and
bonk my head on whatever
head.
Low beam, yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
and go, darn it, I have to fix that. Nick Petrie, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks so much for having me back, Bobby.
Milwaukee author Nick Petrie's latest book in his Peter Ash series is called Light It Up.